All right, and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Snack Time with Mike and Ant. I'm one of your co-hosts, Ant Testator, a freelance names and flavor text writer for Wizards of the Coast and writer at Gathering Magic. And with me, as always, is the lovable collector of weens, Mr. Mike Linneman. And we also have a very special guest today. We have the prolific magic artist, Mr. Randy Gayagas. So welcome to the show.
Hi. Nice to meet you guys.
Did he get that right? Did he get the last name right?
No, he did not. But that's okay.
I did it! What did I do? Close. What did I do wrong? How is it pronounced?
Gallegos.
Gallegos. Okay. Gallegos.
That's another one.
I want to know that too, because people butcher my last name and they've done it for so long that I'm at the point where whatever they say first.
They pronounce the E at the end of your last name, right? They want to say Testatore or something.
Yeah, they want to say Testatore. Yeah. And it's Testator. It's just like Salvatore. Salvatore Testator.
Mm-hmm. So. Just like Bob. We're going to start out the week. We got a great artist on the show, Flavor Gems. I'm going to kick this one off. We got an artist here. I'm going to pick one of his artworks, obviously. And I'm going to choose the giant spider. Did it win an art award? No, it did not. Do we see it all the time? Yes, we do. And the reason being is there's always those commissions, that rare card, mythic card, and it's like, oh, crap, I got to put in extra time for this. People are going to see this. It's going to be valuable. I'm going to sign this forever. I really got to put time in to make this perfect. And every now and then you'll see a group of commissions an artist will have. There's maybe 3, 4, sometimes 5. And there's that one that's just, it's a stinker and they know it, and they kind of punt. And Giant Spider could have been that one, but it isn't. It's this super iconic, everyone's seen this since they started playing the game. It was used in the last core set before Origins, and it's just everything it needs to be. Big spider, cool perspective, it's not real messy, you can look closer and see some hidden details, and it's a solid top-to-bottom image, and those sort of commissions I really love to see, of someone taking, I'm going to put some extra time in. I know people are going to see this a lot. And it also shows this behind-the-scenes view into new players are going to see this. I need to make this iconic. I need to make this simplified that people can easily recognize this. And very well done. I love the piece. And I own the original Giant Spider to Alpha. So if this thing ever shows up, I'm buying it. Straight up.
The original was Sandra Everingham, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you have that. Oh, well done.
I have it. I haven't framed it yet because it takes me
you
a while.
Still to frame. Haven't framed that?
No. See, it's one of those pieces that I have to pick the exact spot, and I have to pick the exact frame. And my framer is an artist himself, and what he does with all of my wood, it's reclaimed wood out of Lake Superior. So when boats sink. To the bottom, he has like these weird people he knows that somehow get it out of there, or it rashes up on shore, or a variety of things. So when he finds certain wood colors or enough of a similar type, he'll give me a call and be like, okay, you got a small piece, I got something for you. And I'm like, okay. So I sneak over there, and I usually get 3 or 4 done at a time. And it's about that time, maybe in about a month here, I'll bring 2 or 3 pieces over there, and we'll get them all done similarly. And you can see this really ingrained, beautiful, hard wood, because it's just petrified of sorts. So it's on my list to do. But regardless, Giant Spider, beautiful piece. Not what Randy probably thought I was going to pick. But I like it. I think it's cool and fun.
It's funny that you have a I have a frame guy, too. His name's Joel. He works at Michael's. And he sells me these, you know, $18 nice little frames that I just throw up.
hey, well, don't mock Michaels too much. They get the job done.
It's not bad, man. He does good. It's good. It's good work. I really like about Giant Spider is that it has 6 eyes. And 2 of them are really big to the point where it looks friendly. Like this, it almost, you're like, aw. And then it's devouring, I'm pretty sure it's a drake, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. But it's just, it's this weird little juxtaposition of this cute, cuddly little, like, oh no, it's slowly consuming this animal.
But that's the weird thing about spiders in general, right? Like when you see a close-up of, you know, the most hideous spider that, you know, you run away from, when you see a close-up, they have these big, adorable Pikachu eyes. And it's it's so weird. They, I don't think they realize how scary they are to people. Like, I think in their world, they're super cute and cuddly.
Right. They're like, why don't you love me? Mm-hmm. They eat mosquitoes. Why you do this?
We have like 15,000 lakes in my state, so spiders are total bros. We
have spiders are awesome.
All the time.
Dude, they're great. It's just the moving. The moving thing is like, it's not natural. It's just such a weird, between that when I'm riding my bike in, you know, near the lake and I just go through a web and it's like that, just like hitting cellophane. It just sucks. That's the worst.
Well, Annie, I got a question. The reason why, the second reason I picked this is every award-winning artwork has been analyzed and asked about 1,000 times. For example, your balance piece. We know everything about it. There's a blog post about it. People ask about it. People don't always ask about giant spider. So
they
I'm
don't.
Curious. Do you have any tidbit or factoid or anything interesting about the creation of this?
Let me think about it. And, you know, it's an old. It was Portal 1, I think it was their first printing of that. So it's quite old. And I do recall very. I mean, I had Sandra's name right on the top of my head because I know that when I did that piece, it was towards the end of when I was still playing. So, you know, I was familiar with her work. I don't know if it had been redone yet. I might have been the first one to redo it. I'm not entirely sure on that point.
No, they had one in 5th edition. Brian Snowdy did one.
I think his was after. Wasn't his after? No.
I think 5th edition was right before Portal. Or it might have been like a tandem.
Yeah, I might have been doing it and then his came out.
Yeah, it was right around the same year. Yeah, same time.
Yeah, but I was thinking about Sandra's and so and I knew it was a, you know, an original piece to the game, and so, you know, redoing something along those lines is I felt a little bit of responsibility, you know, to do a good job on it. It's actually I felt like I put a little more effort, you know, it's an early piece, but than I might have, but you know, like you, I mean, you guys caught it. You might have been looking at a larger scan or something like that. You know, on the card, you do have to actually have one right in front of me here. you have to look a little bit to, you know, to really catch the Drake. But you know, like I felt like it was a fine piece at the time. It was done in acrylic, and I vividly recall painting some parts of it still. It's so old. I was still living with my parents at the time. It was when I did it. Yeah.
That's fantastic. All right, Ant, what do you got for us? What's your pick?
All right, so I got Stern Proctor, which is an Urza Saga card. And the one thing that I really love about this is it's such an interesting and rare type of art description, right, would have been what you got, Randy, was to have a teacher in the middle of class. And when you first look at the card, it just seems it seems weird, you know, being in Magic. But honestly, the ability of, you know, coming into play and returning an artifact or an enchantment to its owner's hand is really nostalgic and reminiscent of being a kid in school and passing notes or playing with a toy in class and having your teacher come by, snatch it up, throw it in that desk drawer, and it's gone forever. You know, like just like Christmas Story when that teacher opens the drawer and it's just full of like chattering teeth and all that stuff. But I love the piece and how you have the three kids that the teacher is facing are all behaving, but the ones behind him, you know, when the back is turned, like they're the ones that are all goofing off and doing all kinds of stuff that kids do, you know, in school.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I've always, between that and the chalkboard, which, you know, kids these days, they don't know what it was like having to clap erasers and stuff like that.
That's right.
So
yeah.
It brings back some good memories of being in school. So, but I don't know. I was more curious. I wanted to ask you if the kids in this piece, if they were inspired by anybody.
You mean their likenesses or what they're doing?
Both. Either.
Yes. I think everything in that was just made up, which is part of why none of it's drawn particularly very well. But you know, I was a bad student. I was, you know, I was getting my name on the board. I was always staying after school because I was talking too much or goofing off or whatever. I was, especially in grade school, I was that kid, you know? So it was very, very easy for me to, think of what that line of kids were doing in the back because I was always getting in trouble.
Not until art classes started, I'm sure. Or did that start early?
Much. No, I didn't start taking real art classes till junior high, I guess. I was awful pretty much until ninth grade. Like once I got to ninth grade, for some reason, I got serious or got depressed, probably got depressed, you know, teenage angst. Prior to that, I was just a stupid kid.
The other thing that I wanted to ask you, and this is going to settle a bet. A buddy of mine is a fan of your work, and I told him that I was talking to you today, and he wanted me to ask you where you signed this card, card art.
Stern Proctor?
Yes.
Offhand? I don't remember.
not like a location, like on the piece. Like, did you sign your name on the piece anywhere?
I should have. I must have. I signed everything at those days.
He's convinced that you signed your name on the chalkboard.
I probably did.
To play up that you got your name on the board?
Yeah, I probably did. That's if I would have had to have guessed, I would have guessed that I would have put it on.
All right, I owe him $5 then.
Yeah. Nice. You know, and I'm really, as we're talking, I'm going to pull it up, my scan, and we'll see if I can solve this definitively.
Do you change where you sign each piece just
randomly? I do. And I think over the course of my illustration career, and for sure, you know, my tenure with Magic, which runs almost the entire length of my illustration career, I've had three different types of signatures as well. And so depending on which signature, you know, which era of my work, I guess you might say, might dictate, you know, how I sign or where I sign. The current one that I'm using, just the little G sigil, which I started using around 2003, you know, it's really small and it fits anywhere, and it's really, you know, it doesn't really get in the way of anything. So that one, he hides himself a lot, actually.
You move it around too. It's never the bottom right.
Yeah, no. Typically I try to find a place where it sits well just as a compositional element.
Okay.
And
is that part because you don't want it off and scrubbed out too? Because that also happens when, you know, it's right prominent. People are like, no,
you know, at least on a Magic piece anyway, that stuff's not, it's so small, it's not going to print anyway. And, you know, Magic cards print so small to begin with that if you can read the signature, it might just be too big for that size of a space. So I'm looking at the high-res scan here that I have for Stern Proctor, and I don't actually see my name on the chalkboard. this is blowing my own mind here. I don't see it on the chalkboard. I don't see it anywhere, which is amazing because it must be signed. But I don't know what happened. You know what? A detail I have noted, and I don't know if you can see this on the card. On the chalkboard itself, on the right side of the chalkboard, there's a little square that's drawn on the chalkboard.
Yes.
Inside of that is that little mechanical gizmo thing that is in the card attunement. When you look at the card attunement, there's these three floating little things he's working on. He's making each one subsequently smaller.
Right.
And on the chalkboard there is a little schematic drawing of one of them. I just noticed that.
Oh, that's super cool.
No way, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's super cool. Huh.
See that? We got a fun fact.
We got a fun Easter egg.
And made $5.
Right below that as well, this is probably impossible to see. There's initials. There's MSP.
Right, that's what he thought was your signature.
No, those are my wife's initials.
Okay.
Then girlfriend's initials. I'm trying to look at what other flavor might be going on here.
That was super bold at the time to totally put that in there.
Oh, totally. That's old school. Yeah. There's a mathematical equation there, which I'm pretty sure I lifted from somewhere. It's legit. I just don't know what it's for or what it represents. But yeah,
do you have the equation? Can you send it? Are we allowed to see the high res one?
I can send you a higher res. Sure.
Cool.
Yeah, because
I was an engineer, so I'm interested in the equation. I just want to see what it is.
Sure, I have no idea anymore, and I probably didn't even know when I found it. It just looked smart, so I picked it.
It looks like it's some kind of, it's like delta equal. I can't really see it, but
I suck at math, and I've always sucked at math, so I could never tell you what that was about.
Well, if I figure it out, I'll let you know.
Cool. Sure. Yeah. That'd be great.
Or I'm sure somebody will be able to figure it out.
This is also one of those images, if you try to Google, there's no high res, because there should never be a high res, sure. But there's not even a larger than average size.
There's a card size res.
Yeah.
There's card size.
And that's okay, because, you know, it's not a great piece. I think it works well on a storytelling level. I like it on that level. But, you know, even at the time, it wasn't a great, you know, technical piece or anything. At the same time, now that I'm looking at it and, you know, with so many years behind, I can almost, you know, shrug it off now. It's like, oh, you know, it was an old piece. So
it was a different time, too. I mean, the entire Urza block had a lot more playfulness.
Yeah.
Whimsy, if you will. That isn't as common anymore. I mean, the folios aren't even here anymore.
So right. So it's from a different... You mentioned that you change your signature depending on certain periods in your career, I guess? Like, is that something that you consciously do, or is it just kind of evolved over time?
It kind of just happened. The first one is just, you know, I used to just paint it, and it was just Randy G with an extending A line, an extending G line. And that one probably went to about 97, somewhere in there. And then it changed to, it was still the Randy G, but it was in a black bar. And that one showed up for a while. It was quite prominent when you saw it because it was in a black bar, but the problem was it was so prominent. So eventually I ditched the whole thing entirely and just switched to using the G, which was a bit more tasteful and not so calling attention to itself.
Interesting.
I'll send you examples of all three.
Oh, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
That would be super, super great to get like an inset of each one. That'd be fun. All right, so, okay, Ryan, what do you got for a flavor, Jim? What are you going to show us?
Can it be the one I mentioned in the little
pre-roll
time?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
My flavor is going to come from a Fallen Empires card called Hymn to Turok, which that was during the period when I was actively playing Magic. I mean, never competitively or anything. I just played casually with friends and my brother and stuff. And Hymn to Turok came in a few different varieties. And the two that I had in my deck, I had two each of the Liz Danforth and Quentin Hoover one, just because I really loved the art so much. And it was a discard deck. So it was really useful for that. And in particular, the Quentin Hoover piece of the two, though I liked them both, the Quentin Hoover piece was one of my favorite early pieces of his. And it was just, I wanted to play that deck so I could come across that card. I wanted to see the card. I wanted to put it down on the table. I mean, it didn't stay out or anything once you put it down, but, you know, nevertheless, you know, you couldn't enjoy it for very long. But I absolutely adored that piece of artwork. And, you know, of his work, which was always so pretty and which I love for that. And the line work was always so graceful. That piece has some really rough line work, a lot of thick and thin line work going on there. It was just really an incredible piece. And in a slight different style, that I'm actually a little surprised that he didn't, I didn't see a lot more of him using, and I never got a chance to ask him, which is interesting. I never asked him, "Hey, why didn't you do more pieces like along these lines?" You know. But anyway, that's my flavor, Jim.
No, that's super. Yeah. Quentin Hoover's it's iconic stuff. I mean, you could pick out his work among everything at the time, and I mean, right now his sons are even trying to figure out how do we get prints made. How should we make a book? I mean, they're getting bombarded from people because it's so beloved by fans and the general public, so I totally get it. This is actually the artwork that I used when I had a black deck.
Yeah, me totally too. This is my Quentin one was my favorite one. It always reminded me of like ink block prints.
Yeah,
because thick stylistic lines. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think I saw that that Liz Danforth just sold hers not long ago.
It's so
she did a whole article about it, right, or an interview where she talked about her process.
Yep. She did a big blog post on it and then sold it. I think it's moved hands once since then.
Already? That wasn't long ago.
it was sold, I think, right around the recession, and then, you know, a lot of pieces moved because people were like, "Oh, I have kids. Oh, I have a lot of money boiled up in art," which happens to people. Sure. So, I think where it is now, it's going to be sitting there a long, long while. So,
it was a great piece.
It really is. So, Ryan, we have favorite works. We just showcased a few. But we'd love to know. So, had a long career in illustration. We're talking about Magic today. We're going to talk about some of the other fine art things in a few moments. But is there a couple pieces that we can put together from your career in working on just this one brand and use it almost as a timeline to say, okay, when I hit this piece, it won an art award, and that projected me up to the next level. Or when I worked on this piece, I tried this thing. I tried a different medium, or I tried oil painting, and it unlocked this other aspect. Can you think of a few of those along your career, just with Magic alone, because there's over 100, that have really pushed you forward, that might have been challenging too?
Yeah, the three that come to mind usually when I think about this question, and they do kind of span kind of early, middle, late portion of my working on Magic, would be Soul Warden, Council of the Soratami, and Balance, which you mentioned a little while ago. Soul Warden was the early one. That was Exodus, I believe. That one was still, it was still when I was working in acrylics. I worked in acrylics until about 98, and then I switched over to oils. And I think it's one of my most successful magic pieces, and probably one of my better illustrations of that era, you know, in general, of my acrylic period. I'll say something that ties all three together a little later. But so it was really, you know, successful on those fronts. It was also one of the early occasions where there was a detail in the art description that, you know, I didn't, like, I had the sketch, you know, for what I knew was going to be at least a decent piece. And there was a detail in the art description where they had her kind of pronouncing, you know, having these blessings going on to this creature. I forget what the Kor or something like that, K-O-R, I think they were. And so, you know, they're kind of passing before her, and you can see on the bottom of the card, one of them's, you know, kind of just the side of its head as it's walking by her, and it's got one of these little blessing type things floating over its head. But I really didn't want it in the piece. And so this is before, you know, everyone did everything digitally. So I painted that head on a piece of, I don't know, some kind of transparent, you know, material, and basically adhered it to the painting, which is done in acrylic. And then I painted its little magic thing, maybe in gouache or something like that, so that when I got it back, I could actually remove them and just have, you know, the Soul Warden, you know, in her pose with kind of the magic floating around.
How fun.
So it was an early example, you know, of me kind of, you know, separating the finished artwork from the illustration and allowing it to do both jobs, both be satisfying as a painting that stood on its own, as well as, you know, working as to fulfill the client's what, you know, what they needed the card to do.
First one. Who is this person? Did you have a reference for this?
My wife posed for it, but it's not her. Usually, you know, if she poses for things, you know, I'll kind of change it up, you know, so it doesn't look like the same person all the time. But, you know, she actually posed for that one.
You mean by if, it's more so when? Because it's, you know, I need some help with this reference.
Yeah,
because there's always more reference to be done. Like, can you help me study this, please?
Yeah, right. Especially in those days, you know, like now I bring in more different, you know, people I meet and other friends, or, you know, occasionally hire models. But back then, I had a pretty limited pool of friends and girlfriend one. So, you know, the majority of my female characters, she ended up posing for over the years, and that none of them look too much like her, I guess, is I guess it means I did my job fairly well. The second piece is Council of the Soratami from Champions of Kamigawa, if I'm not mistaken. And that one was important. It was right, you know, it was after my switch to oils. Not only was it after my switch to oils, it was right around the time where I started to really get a hang of the oils. I switched around 98, like I said, but it probably took, you know, a good, you know, I don't know, a good few years where I really got my hand on it, you know, start to understand what I'm going to do with it and how I'm going to use it. I had just changed my, you know, my signature to that G logo not long before that, although it's a sloppy representation of it on that one. It hadn't quite been refined yet. Because I felt, you know, that it kind of represents, you know, changing my signature at that point represented what I thought was a, you know, an upgrade of my aesthetic, I guess. I felt that I had, you know, kind of moved past some problems that I had had. And that piece in particular, came after kind of a rough creative patch that I went through right around 2000, 2001. I kind of was out of the game for a little bit, and I wasn't doing a lot of illustration in general. I took a day job at a video game company for a little while to just help pay the bills along, you know, while I was kind of figuring out what I was doing. But it was a pretty rough patch, and I felt like I was just getting my legs under me again when that set was commissioned. And, you know, I think I had probably done some pieces that WASI hadn't been too happy with at that, you know, prior to that, which would have been like Mirrodin era, I think, Mirrodin block. And Jeremy Cranford, who was the art director at the time, I think he was kind of just giving me like kind of a one last chance kind of thing. And so he's like, here's a piece. I'm not going to tell you anything. Just, you know, pick something out of the style guide and paint something cool. And when he gave it to me, you know, on the one hand, I was super stoked about that. And on the other hand, I think I knew what that meant, that, you know, if I didn't deliver something good, that was probably it. And it all came together. It's a taller piece than prints on the card.
Big.
It's a little bigger than usual. It's 11 by 17. And it's one of a handful of pieces that I still own and that my wife has kind of forbidden me to sell. Soul Warden, I think we regret selling a little bit. But the guy who bought it still owns it, I found out not long ago. He got back in contact with me. And I was so super happy to hear that he still has it.
There's something to that of, you know, I shook your hand when you were like a teenager and they're like, oh, I value it every day. I love seeing it every day. And you're like, okay, artist, you know, achievement done. Thank you. That's so wonderful to hear.
Yeah. You know, I don't mind the collector's game of buying and selling and, you know, and flipping and making money on things. But, you know, for a piece that's really near and dear to your heart, to see it kind of, you know, to see that happen to it, that wouldn't feel so hot. But, you know, knowing that this guy's really, really enjoying the piece. And if he sells it, you know, no hard feelings or anything. But it was really special to me that over the years he still has it. So that's the second one. And then the third one was Balance, as I mentioned, which is from the vault sets. And that one was notable for a few reasons as well. It's my largest Magic piece. It's 18 by 24 inches at a time when people didn't paint that large as regularly as they do now. Like, it's become more of a, you know, it's become more of a regular size for some people. But, you know, for me, it was a big piece, and I knew it was a high visibility card that had only been redone once, I think, and that by Kev Walker, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Which, you know, going from an early piece, I think of Mark Poole, the original. So an original piece that was already important at the time to a piece that was redone by Kev Walker, like, you know, you can't mess that up. And, you know, and I was super happy with it. I did a ton of work to get that piece where it needed to be. Another one that, you know, I kind of, you know, I sold it for a nice chunk of change at the time. And man, I kind of wish I had it back. But again, the guy who bought it is just a super good collector. And I know him, I've gotten to know him a little bit. And he's like, I even told him, I said, you know, you can probably make four times what you paid for that. I wanted him to know, because he collects art and, you know, you can sell a piece and buy a ton more art with it. And he's like, nope, not selling it. You know, so again, you know, I'm really happy that two pieces I loved so much went to homes that, you know, really care for them like that. So those are my three. And, you know, all three were sort of plateau breakers for me in a sense. They're pieces that kind of point to where you're going next when you do them. Like, they surprise you as an artist even a little bit when you do them, because you know that they're better than, you know, than what you've been doing. But sometimes when an artist breaks a plateau with a piece, it doesn't necessarily mean that everything they do going forward is going to match that. What it does is it kind of shows you a peek at what you're going to do in that next phase. And, you know, it's your first look at it at that kind of level of work. And you'll spend the next, you know, few years or whatever, you know, getting to the point where you can do that kind of thing more reliably. Then once you're kind of there, hopefully that next plateau comes and kind of, again, shows you the vision of where your work is going. And I think all three of those pieces kind of did that for me. They also have, if you look at them side by side, they all have kind of a similar aesthetic sensibility.
It has a fine art feel to them.
Yeah, and they, you know, they all have a sensibility that carries over my personal work quite a bit. So if you look at a lot of my personal work, they actually sit quite well with those three pieces. You know, there's a sense of dreaminess to it, kind of an ethereal quality, maybe a focus more on beauty over brawn. They're all focused on the figure and maybe more about an inner sense than an outer.
They're all very calm, instead of the rushing into battle warrior sort of sensibility.
There are some guys who do that super awesome, and I love that kind of work. And, you know, like, I wish I could do it more. Like, there's a part of me that likes doing that, but I haven't, you know, like, having flexed that muscle a lot, you know, I haven't worked that muscle a lot over the years. And so I know there's just some guys who are just naturally, you know, way better at doing that sort of thing. But, you know, I find that, you know, left to my own devices, this is kind of where my aesthetic goes, and these three pieces all seem to embody that along the way.
And two of them even won art awards by Spectrum. I mean, both.
That's right.
Also, yeah. Also, Council.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I wonder if Soul Warden would have gotten it. I wasn't submitting very often to Spectrum in the early days.
Wizards wasn't either. That only happened maybe around when Jarvis started and Cranford was on the way out. They really started ramping up, sending in 20, 30 pieces instead of, you know, one or two here and there.
Yeah, no, it's a great idea that they started doing that, you know, started realizing that it's good for them too, so.
It's a fantastic strategy to say, hey, we have amazing artists, look. It's like, oh, I want to work for that company. I mean, it really is that night and day. Tor does the same thing, and they're like, oh, okay, I do that sort of art, I should work for them. And you can see the companies that used to, that don't, you don't really see them anymore. There's some sort of, I don't know, fine art quality of, oh, their art probably isn't good enough anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to, it's hard to number that, you know, the people who collect a product like Magic and but don't play and just like the art. You know, I run into them at signings all the time. They'll be like, I don't even play. I just buy the cards because I like the art. Like, does okay, it? There you go. You know, you're one ant. Or, I mean, I think you do play now, right?
But
you
didn't I, well, I've always game. Played, but it's not, oh, it's not like a priority for me. I don't care if I win. I just like have fun. But yeah, the majority of my cards are just there because I enjoy looking at them. I frame them and put them on walls and stuff.
Yeah. So there's always been this, you know, admittedly quite small, but numerically significant, you know, given the total pool of people who buy Magic, who probably just buy because they love the art so much, you know, and it's hard to say how many of those are, but that they exist, you know, a place like the Spectrum Book is a great place for someone, you know, be like, all this art is all has in common, this, like, you know, who the art director is or whatever, or who the client is, you know, I want to know why is all this amazing art out there in this product, and then they probably end up being part of these, you know, nameless masses, or nameless minorities, at least, of, right. of people who buy the product just for the art.
It's almost a strategy. Hooks them in. They get...
Yeah, but that's not a strategy I imagine you could sell well upstairs. Oh, no, we need to submit to this book. Why do you have to submit to this? Because people are going to see it and buy our cards for the art. No, they won't, you know, like, just get back to work.
People buy the cards to keep playing the cards.
Also, get back in the pit. So do you still have other artworks at home? Like, how many do you have currently with
I probably have about 20 total of the total. Up to 20, somewhere in there. I had them on my site for a while, and I was regularly selling them. And then as I got down to this kind of smaller number, I think I realized, oh, crap, like, you know, this is it. You know, I haven't been painting a lot of Magic recently. And, you know, I'm selling it at this point, at this rate, faster than I'm painting it. So, and the market was really kind of taking off around that time. And I didn't, and I, you know, I still don't quite have a good handle on why and on what, you know, what's happening there. And, you know, it's really unpredictable. You get some pieces that, you know, go for quite a bit of money. Some pieces that, you know, are offered up, you know, like you see on Facebook, hey, it's $600 for this piece. And it's like, what? Like, you know, how can that piece still go for $600 these days? You know, like it's a kind of a Wild West time right now. And I thought, you know, I don't understand this market well enough to have so few pieces still out and about. So I just yanked them all. I've got a number of sketches and drawings still. And when I moved recently, so when I moved out here, I went through some old boxes that I had been in storage for a while. And found some, you know, minor sketches for really older pieces, like some thumbnails or, you know, very small, just little bits on the backs of, you know, very interesting. So, you know, there's a few of those around too. But I think I'm going to hold on to them for a bit more still before I, you know, start putting any of them back out on the market again.
Probably wise at this point. Watching the art market in there, it's very, very strange because it's an emerging art market. Like any contemporary thing to break out, there's going to be a few big collectors right away scooping things up, but at the same time you don't want heavy speculators buying too much work, because then not enough collectors can know about it to buy in and, you know, create a community. So it's a really strange area that some of us can write about to say, okay, well, this is comparable to like comic art of this strange style of like the early 80s in Romania or something. Because it's such a strange model. There's no other game that has really been similar to this and had this many people see it. Because the art is known. It's almost it's almost like a movie or a game or some sort of video game that everyone knows what it is. But those people don't actively purchase it until they're 30, 40 years old. So they have almost a shelf life of 20 years of appreciation before it finally gets bought, which is very, very strange in the art world for something to be known that long before it gets bought.
Yeah. So, I mean, I always feel like there's, you know, there has to be a generational changeover where the teams or whatever that are playing it have to, you know, age up to a place of financial stability so that they can all go back and nostalgic at the same time and want to own this thing, you know, that was so important to them when they were young. And, you know, with Magic, at least in the gaming world, you know, the only thing it could compare itself to earlier would have been D&D, which was kind of like Magic for the prior generation in a sense. And, you know, but it's hard to compare them because while there was a lot of art for D&D and the old art is going to hold its value for a while, probably there just wasn't nearly as much of it, you know, as Magic. Right. And even if you say early Magic, and even if you say, you know, the first 5 years of Magic, that's still a few thousand pieces, you know, more than the entire body of, you know, first and second edition, you know, color work. So, you know, it's really...
ton of work.
And so it's weird to me to see, you know, some of this early work I guess, to appreciate as fast as it has. I thought that the inventory would keep the prices low for a long, long time. But, you know, the amount of painted work is low still, and, you know, probably isn't going to grow too much going forward. I mean, there are some digital guys who are switching over to painting because they're hoping to get on that game, but they still have to do a good job.
They fully get that.
Yeah, they still have to do a good job on the illustration, right, though. And if their skills were, you know, digital first, then, you know, there's a slight risk that if they take a small step down in quality, that they're going to get spanked for that. So it's a little risky. And but, you know, I'm super stoked to see it happening. I just, you know, it's a young market still. And, you know, I'm curious to see what happens in the next few years. Hopefully we don't get another recession or China doesn't bring down the entire world economy and, you know, send the whole thing plummeting. You know.
Honestly worried about. There's actually a few big collectors in China that honestly just scoop up and just buy out things. I mean, they haven't been to LXCon yet, but they will eventually. I'm well aware that this
for will. Magic as well, they do that?
Oh, yeah. Because what's happening is it's becoming geek chic now. Because most other geeky brands, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, they're very accessible. You can walk in and say, oh, I know this. I read the book. I saw the movies. Weekend, I totally get it right away. And you can cosplay and get into it very quickly. Magic has a learning curve. It's, I kind of understand what's going on. Not really. I mean, there's a whole tournament scene and there's valuation differences and playing the game is very difficult. So you have to be quite invested and quite knowledgeable before you invest in the game. You can't just play it for $10.
And even then the setting changes every year. So you can't, you know what I mean? Like Harry Potter's setting doesn't change. It's always Hogwarts. You can bet your money that a Hogwarts painting is going to make sense. You know what I mean? But you can't come in and be like, oh, I'm going to buy some Minas Tirith stuff. And everyone's like, that's 5 years ago. We're not into that anymore. You know, you're totally behind. Mm-hmm. The only safe bet would be Planeswalkers if you didn't know enough. But if you don't know enough, how do you know
That's right.
You're supposed to be buying Planeswalkers, like you don't. So.
And that this feeds into this advertising scheme of, is there a TV show coming? Is there a cartoon coming? Is it going to broach into very popular culture soon? And that some of that panic is with art collectors to think, oh God, I got to pick up this stuff before it becomes mainstream, and then I have to fight geeky celebrities for paintings because I'm never going to win that game. So
yeah, and with such a long product, with such a long, you know, it's had such a long life at this point, you know, you're going to have kind of multiple generations, you know, graduating up to collector status, you know.
Right.
And so it's not like, oh, this was really hot for 10 years and then it died or whatever, and people come back and they buy out that work. No, you can have this, you know, continuing line of people joining the ranks.
So on that note of having this, that you've been in this market-driven behavior because you ran this conglomerate of sites in the past, this Daydream Graphics. And I remember watching this whole process kind of unwind of, oh, yeah, Randy's got a bunch of guys. They kind of do this. I didn't all know if you all lived in the same place and you were like roommates. You weren't. But how this kind of all shook out. But for those people that don't know, there was a website and it had sub-websites of sorts, and Jeremy Jarvis was on it.
Jeremy was never on it, but there were a number of Magic
Matt
guys.
Matt Fabata was never on it.
Yes, Matt was. Yes,
he was. Who was on the list? And give us a background on how this thing worked.
Yeah, so I mean, it's old history now. I mean, it ended in 2011. Well, that's ancient as far as, you know, the internet's concerned. I ran Daydream Graphics, talk about old history, from 96, I think it was, until 2011. So I was just getting going. I was, you know, new to the game. I was hungry and I was eager and, you know, had a lot more energy maybe than I do now. So the internet, you know, was still fairly new, and it would come on AOL discs in the mail. I mean, it was the horrible days of Netscape Navigator 2 and 3, you know, like, you know, this is really early days. And I was really interested in getting aboard and getting a website to show my work. But I was really young. You know, some people knew me because of Magic, but, you know, certainly I wasn't a big name or anything. And so I thought, you know, well, you know, it might be a lot of work to do this, and to do it just for me doesn't make any sense. So, but I figured that there were a lot of artists who didn't have websites in that time still who, you know, maybe they'd want one. And, you know, there's a lot of work necessary. You know, there wasn't any Squarespace or WordPress or anything back then. Like, if you wanted a website, you had to make a website. And if you wanted it to have, you know, any sales ability, you had to you know, get a process, you know, merchant processing account and do all of this, you know, jump through all these hoops. And I was willing to do that work. So I contacted some of my artist friends and they're like, oh, okay, cool. And the way I ran it was, as you said, it wasn't so much like a, I mean, I did sales for all of them like a gallery, but, you know, I didn't run it like a gallery in the sense that every artist kind of had their own space and they all had their .coms if they wanted them. And so essentially you were going to their website. I was running and maintaining those websites. They'd send me content and price lists and things and I would upload them and then I would handle sales for them. Artists came and went. I'm pretty sure I stayed on good terms with every single artist that came and went. And I was really proud of that, that, you know, there weren't any, bad deals or whatever that soured relationships or anything. You know, guys like, one of the early ones would have been like Matthew Wilson, who I was buddies with from Legend of the Five Rings. Then he went on to Magic and then went on to Privateer Press, RK Post, Therese Nielsen, Adam Rex, before he became a children's book superstar. Right. Quentin Hoover was on there, Matt Cavada. There's a bunch of guys and some people who didn't really work on Magic so much, but maybe worked on other card games at the time. And like I said, you know, people come, people came, people went. And then over time, like, you know, the web standards kept changing, you know, significantly. And, you know, the payment processing standards changed significantly. And like it became harder and harder to keep up with those standards. And, you know, it was getting to the point where I knew that if I was going to keep the website going, I was going to have to revamp the whole thing from scratch again. And I had done that once, like around 2000, 2001, and put in place like a shopping cart structure and moved it all over to ASP and stuff. But I knew I was going to have to do a whole other thing. And, you know, it was kind of slowing down a little in that artists weren't really updating as much. Some guys had switched to digital, you know, and it was just like, you know what, if I'm going to get out, like, this is a good time to do it. So I decided to go ahead and cut loose from that and just focus more on my own work. And, you know, because, I mean, it did take a decent amount of time. And in the good right. years, you know, I was really happy to be able to write some nice fat checks to some artists who sold really great. You know, I felt really good to be contributing to other artists' livelihood and doing it. Like, I took as small a commission as I could possibly take and make it worth my while. I was never late on a payment to anybody. You know, like, I ran the business the way I wish everyone ran an art business or when they deal with artists. And so, you know, I learned a lot. I got to know a lot of great artists and see a lot of great work. One of the great stories from that era that, you know, I'll tell it now, but no one else knows about it. I worked with Drew Tucker for a while. And when Drew started out, I was like, okay, so I need you to send me like some scans or whatever, you know, of your work. And he's like, can I just like send you some work? And you can scan it and send it back. And I was like, you can totally do yes. that. Like, that's risky, yes. but yes, you can do that. And he sent me a lot of art. Like, he sent me a box with a lot of paintings in there. And, you know, it was an absolute joy. Like, that never happened. Everyone just sent me scans. I didn't want their art. I didn't want the responsibility of having to care for their art. So, you know, they got to keep it and then just mail it out when it sold. But he sent me this box of paintings that I just oogled over forever and scanned them and then sent them all back. And it all worked out well. I think I bought them, actually, out of that stack. So it worked out well for him. But that was a cool. particularly good memory that I had.
Secret marketing technique. Just send you a box of my work. He's sitting at home like, yes,
that's right.
You will buy one.
Brilliant.
Oh, that's funny. So, all right. So that's you know, your past, yeah. right? What are you doing now? So Mike sent me a picture the other day of a Sega Genesis controller. And
which is awesome.
I saw it on my phone and I was just like, why are you sending me a picture of a Sega controller? Like, just totally didn't think twice about it, whatever. Then happened to look at it again earlier today and I realized it was painted. And it blew me away. Like, just totally... was so from phone size, that thing is so realistic looking.
Yeah,
it's just like insane. So I'm really curious, like, what is that for?
So that's part of a series of pieces that I've been calling Hearts for Hardware. And so I'm of that generation too, right? Like, I just talked about how people have to, you know, they have to age up a certain amount and then they suddenly get, you know, they get a little bit of money and they get a little bit of nostalgia for things that they grew up with. And so, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people probably, you know, I figure if I am, then there's a lot of people in my age group that are getting super nostalgic for this old stuff, you know, all this old video game stuff. And I was always a super huge geeky video gamer. Like, I think I've probably downplayed the amount of video game geekiness that I have involved myself in over the years. Mm-hmm. Maybe just, you know, because it wasn't as acceptable in the past maybe, but it's since it's become a little more acceptable, I guess I feel a little, bolder in being a very out geek. And so the story itself starts, you know, it's a lot longer. I don't know how much time you guys want to go into it. But I mean, the point of the series is to, gosh, how can I do this without going the long route? Can I go the long route?
Just go the long route.
Right. Route. Start from scratch.
Go long.
All right. So this is, I'm going to relate this, you know, because there's some other artists who will listen to this as well. And yes. this will be fun for both the artists and the non-artists. For the artist, you know, there was an article that Dave Palumbo wrote and posted on Muddy Colors not long ago about doing personal work. And, you know, I totally like, you know, everything in that article I absolutely agree with. And, you know, Dave's own work is a good example of what those practices can result in. And, you know, Hearts for Hardware may be along those lines for me. A couple of years ago, I challenged myself to do a kind of a 4 by 6 foot kind of big, kind of epic sized fantasy painting. And I showed it at a LuxCon. I'll have it at my gallery show, which we'll talk about in a little bit, maybe. And, you know, I had never worked that big before. And I wanted to do something, maybe, I don't know, maybe because I was approaching 40 or something. You know, maybe I thought, you know, I have to make a statement here before I cross out of the first half of my life or whatever. And so I did this giant painting, and it took me a month, and I was really happy with it. It, you know, in a sense, you know, if it ended up being kind of the culmination of the first 40 years of my life, like I'm totally happy viewing it that way. You know, super happy with it. But I spent a month, you know, solid, you know, working long hours to finish it so I could show it at a LuxCon. And one day in the middle of that, like I was a little, frankly, a little tired, you know, and I needed a break from working on this giant painting. So my wife had brought along, she had gone to some farmer's markets and she had some fruits and vegetables, and there's this really gorgeous squash, and I'm getting to the hardware, but this is the long route. And so I pulled the squash out and I painted it. I just did a still life, which I hadn't done a still life in oils probably since college, you know, and I had this super amount of fun painting the squash. And I thought, you know what? That was so much fun that now I'm re-energized to go back to my big painting. And, you know, when I, after I'm done with this, I'm going to come back and paint some more still lives. So, you know, over the months that followed, I did a number of, you know, other fruits and vegetables and stuff like that. And, you know, I've really enjoyed that as kind of an experiment lab just for painting and, you know, trying out new things and, you know, having the freedom to fail, which is something that I recommend to other artists, is give yourself a place where you have the freedom to fail. Because when you illustrate and you do stuff for clients, like you can't fail, you know, I mean, you do regularly, but you can't, you know, it's bad for you. And you need a place where you're going to try stuff. And so for me, the fruits and vegetables, you know, ended up being some of that. For instance, you know, like when I paint pretty tight, but it actually starts pretty loose. And then I go in and I use a blender brush to kind of, you know, pull these, you know, brush strokes together. It's kind of a weird, you have to see it. But, you know, so in the end, I have these really polished surfaces, you know, on my paintings that are built of a hatchwork of more aggressive brushwork. And it keeps it, in my mind, it keeps it from looking too plastic when you look at the originals. The colors kind of interweave a little more and there's a little more vibrance between the colors. And I love that and I'll continue doing that. But for these pieces, I thought I'm just going to leave the blenders away and just, you know, straight paint application, you know, it's a little faster that way. And I'm just going to, you know, play around with that. Well, anyway, a few months later, this would be like a year and a half ago, from today. I wanted to do some more still life work, but I didn't have any. I think it was probably in the middle of winter. So it would have been like February or March or whatever. And there was just nothing good in season that was in the house to paint. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to paint these video game controllers I have. And because one of the things I found with, you know, thinking about still life, and I hadn't thought about still life in a while, and now I was looking at it when I went to the museums or whatever, I was looking at still life paintings, is, you know, one of the most interesting things about still life paintings is you get this object which is totally everyday, like an apple or a video game controller, and you see it all the time, and it exists in your world, and you behold it the way you behold any other object, and suddenly you see it painted on a wall, and you absolutely look at that object differently than you ever did. The fact that even if it's absolutely photorealistic, you're actually looking at that apple or that whatever in a way that you never look at an apple on a table. And to me, that is a really fascinating thing about still life painting. And I thought, you know what? What would happen if I did this like video game controller? Like I've never actually looked at it. I've never like beheld it. You know, I've held it certainly hours and hours and hours on end. And, you know, like when I see old video game hardware, like, you know, of course it brings back memories or whatever, but I've never actually tried to look at it as artwork. And so, you know, I'm going to paint this stuff. And so I painted a couple of pieces and it was super fun. And it had that effect. Like suddenly I was looking at it and I would look at the painting and it was an object that is, you know, that I was appreciating for its own aesthetic qualities. Very, very interesting and super fun. And I thought, you know what? I wonder if this is a thing. I should maybe try a couple of other of these. And so I did a couple of others, you know, kind of between projects, I would paint a few. And, you know, I was like, you know, I think this is a thing. I think I should do this. I think I should maybe make a series out of this stuff. And so I, you know, sat around for a while and thought about the parameters of what the series was going to be like, you know, what I intended by it, you know, how much I wanted to do of it. And it's quite extensive, the plans that I had in mind, you know, like it could easily go into a couple of hundred paintings. I put a spreadsheet out and, you know, like I've always been into the history of video games and, you know, I've owned hardware since like the 2600. So, you know, I put a spreadsheet out and like started laying out all the different paintings that I could do. And it was quite long. And I thought to myself, man, you know, like, don't do this if you're just going to wuss out after, you know, 5, 6, 7 paintings or whatever. Okay. But I kept doing them. And I was like, no, I think this is, you know, unless it, you know, it, no one likes them and, you know, they never sell or anything, then, you know, like, I think this could be a lot of fun. Yeah. I realized that I probably enjoyed doing it a lot when I was painting the exhaust vents on the side of I think it was a PlayStation or something. It's like all these, you know, consoles have exhaust vents, right?
What?
And it's the absolute most boring thing that you can imagine painting. There's just these straight lines and it's like, there's just a bunch of them. And I was like, I'm actually having fun doing this. Like,
that's awesome.
This is probably worthwhile. This is probably going to be something I can do for a while. If I can enjoy painting this, this is probably going to be fun. So, you know, and I was champing at the bit to like show them to people, you know, but I really wanted to, you know, wanted to bring it into the world, you know, in a way that made sense, in a way that people would, you know, that there would actually be this body of work ready to go in case I was really busy, you know, and didn't have time to do more pieces or whatever. So I built up a bunch and held on to them for almost a year and a half, you know, until I showed any of them around, so it was, which was really hard and also allowed me the time to really think through whether I was going to do this thing. Julie from Crab Jab Studios, Julie Barrow, old school magic artist and awesome person, contacted me about doing a solo show there, and she didn't know I had these pieces. You know, I think she was just thinking, you know, some of my you know, fine art kind of figurative stuff or some illustration. And so we started talking, and I was like, well, you know, it could be like a retrospective of my illustration. I could do some of this figurative stuff, but it's slow, and it, you know, I'm not going to be able to put a lot of wall space together because, you know, it takes a long time to do them. Or I've got this other set of like video game stuff. And she was actually the first person outside of my house, I think, to see them. And she had the absolutely crazy idea of saying, let's do all three. And I was like, I don't know how that makes any sense. And so we just kept talking and, you know, we put a concept together for a show. And so this is the first time I'll be showing them in public. And I just, in the last like 2 months or whatever, started talking about them in general, which I'm super happy to be doing because I've been sitting on them for a long time now. So that's the long way around.
So that's the okay. Back up. Back up. Video game controllers. How many are we talking here?
Okay, so it's video game controllers. It's also the consoles. And there's, you know, handhelds. Okay. You know, you throw those in there too. So, I mean, there's a lot. Like, if you really start thinking about it, and not only that, but there are variants too, right? So like,
or just like the Pokemon or, well, whatever.
More like design like forms.
Like how far back did you go though? Did you go all the way back to Atari?
I went back to like the Odyssey. Like
you Odyssey, know, okay. Like, okay. You know,
I mean, that's, I don't know, you know, there's not a huge market for the Bally Astrocade, you know, like they only sold, you know, a few thousand units or whatever, but still, like, you know, in the interest of making this kind of being a historical project as well, like I thought that was really interesting. And I never owned a Bally Astrocade. That was before my time,
right.
You know,
so
I
you had to pick one up in order to paint it, right? Like you have the physical object sits. I mean, that's still life. You have it sitting in front of you.
Yeah. I tend to work from photos from these because some of them have, you know, some of them relate to one another in space, and so like it would take a lot of room to have them out. Or some of them, okay, you know, are floating or dangling. Like, you know, if there's a way in which, you know, there's something about that hardware, something I can bring into the painting to give it a little more, you know, a little creative bump, like I'll do that. Otherwise, like a straight up, you know, still life is fine too. But there's a few pieces where they have, you know, kind of maybe in jokes, or they just, you know, they reference something else about the hardware system.
Okay, so then the following question is, obviously, if you're going to be having wide swath, many different things, how will you have any sort of consideration for more popular systems. For example, PlayStation controllers, super iconic. Will there be one of each generation or will there be multiple? Because I'm thinking of people walking in there and be like, oh my God, I hope nobody gets there before I do. I need that Genesis controller,
yeah,
right?
It's a really good question. You know, my wife and I have talked about this one as well because, like, you know, for instance, I did a Nintendo, just an 8-bit Nintendo set, right? And for that one, I did play for most of the consoles. I'm doing player one, player two, and they're, you know, so the in the console you can see the ports are plugged in, and then there's, you know, a painting of one controller, a painting of the other controller, and so in that one there's actually two of them. But, like, you know, once that set is sold, like, will I ever paint a standard Nintendo again? Like, I don't know. It's a good question. Like, maybe what I would do is, you know, if I paint another one, it would be, you know, not on its own. It would be in some, you know, because right now it's like, you know, the console is one painting and then each controller is a smaller painting. Maybe something where it's like all set together or something. I don't know. I recognize that might take away some of the specialness of, you know, of the guy who owned the original. But then again, right, like, I imagine there might be a lot of people who want a Nintendo painting. So I don't know. You know, it's a good question. I haven't made any decisions on that yet. I know, like, with the PlayStation ones, from the original PlayStation, the two player one, player two on that, and when I can do this, I'll do it, are the iterations of the controllers. So, for instance, you know, player one was the original. It didn't have any analogs on it. And right, the player two is the original, like the DualShock that has the dual analogs. The Genesis, you know, player one is the standard 3-button controller. Player two was the later 6-button controller that came out. So I'll do things like that as well. You know, it gives me an easy out when I get to some of the later, like, four port consoles, like Dreamcast and stuff like that, because I can just paint four controllers, you know, and, like, why not?
Right.
Yeah.
And even later on, like especially the N64, they had the regular controller, then they went in with the Rumble Pack, then they had the see-through controllers, and they had the special edition gold control.
That's
like, they've had so many different things.
So that one will be one where the colors matter more because, or like you said, the see-through, because they never actually changed the form factor on the N64 controller.
Right,
they usually do some kind of an upgrade on a form factor along the way, but that one they never did. Except
they just had the things that you put in the bottom.
That's right, like the Rumble Pack and stuff.
Right,
so on that
one,
it probably would be like, you know, a see-through one with the Rumble Pack, maybe the gold one, you know, things like that. Yeah.
Now, if you want to go back and redo the 8-bit Nintendo, though, you can do the robot that used to come with it.
Oh, don't worry. He's on the list. Yeah. I'm you know, usually when I'm hitting a console, like, I'm not going to do all of the pieces that are associated with it at once. Like, I'll kind of space them out. So, because, you know, the Nintendo probably will, you know, is going to be gone. And someone that finds out about this series, you know, a few months from now, will be like, oh, where's Nintendo, dude? It's like, it's long gone, you know? So I'll kind of space him out, and Rob will make his appearance probably at some point.
And that begs that question. Then you have a gallery show. It's going to be Crab Jab September 12th through October 3rd. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have every console in this show. You're not going to have every controller.
No, everything that I haven't done a ton of them. I think there's like 16 or 17 pieces so far. I haven't shown them all yet. I've shown a handful of them, so there's a few that'll be surprises when the show opens. And so, no, not everything is, not nearly everything is going to be represented yet. I mean, there's entire generations that won't have, you know, been represented yet. So definitely this continues on past the show. The show is just a good launch point for it.
Interesting. So what will happen? So you get through all of them, then will there be another show? Will there be some sort of open studio presentation? Are you going to bring out some systems and play? Can you bring soda and pizza over? Like, how is there something else?
I don't know. I haven't, you know, in terms of, you know, the show thing, we'll see how the gallery show goes. I'm hoping that, you know, obviously the people are excited about the pieces, and, you know, if they sell well, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if Julie and I maybe end up talking about doing something else in the future. That would be awesome. If not, you know, if it's kind of a one and done situation, then as I move forward with the paintings, I'll have to really think about, you know, how I'm going to use the paintings themselves, you know, how I'm going to show them or sell them, or whether it's just through my website or whether I try to find other venues. Maybe there's other, you know, kind of more younger modern galleries even that, you know, that might be interested in it. So there's a few options. There's also the possibility of doing some giclées with some of the popular pieces, so I don't know. There's, you know, some of the stuff I've thought about, some of it I just haven't made decisions on a lot of it yet. And so part of it has been waiting on revealing the work and seeing what the interest level is, and, you know, seeing if it's a thing. I thought it'd be a thing. Let's see if it's a thing.
I totally. I'm already thinking of our local gallery we have in Minneapolis called the Light Gray Art Lab, and they do geeky things all the time. They reimagine the entire Pokemon crew. Each artist got one piece. They would kill people to get one of to get this in any sort, or even posters, or oh my god, they would lose their absolute mind. So
yeah, I mean, you know, one thing I would like.
They're getting a link right away.
One thing I would love is that, you know, on the one hand, yeah, you know, like I make my living as a painter, so you know, of course, I hope the pieces sell. And you know, if they failed and if they didn't sell well, I probably wouldn't continue too much further because you know it's an expensive hobby to collect all this stuff, all these consoles.
Right.
I'm in the hole right now on this project. So, in terms of the paintings themselves, you know, I like the idea that they're art, and you know, like I don't want to get too you know artsy fartsy about it, but I think there is an art component to it. I think there is a value to the pieces themselves as works of art and what it means, you know, for objects, you know, to be. Translated and to be taken out of the original context and shown to you in a different way. And like art is interesting in that way.
Is that a Duchamp reference right there?
This is not a pipe. Yeah.
Is this your it totally is. It totally
so I would love, you know, I would love the, you know, a next batch of paintings to be shown together if possible and maybe sold together, not necessarily to one person, but, you know, in a kind of a gallery context where people are seeing it as art. I mean, it would be easy maybe to sell them just on my website. But you know, obviously if they sold well, I'd be happy about that part of it, but I would love for them to continue to be experienced in a way that, continues to make them, I guess, work together as artworks.
And this feels really, really highly relevant of taking a high designed thing you see every day. You don't think about it. You just use it. And
yeah, maybe you trash it, right? Broke.
Yeah, you throw it. I mean, whatever. Yep. And then you take it out of that mode, throw it on your wall, and this high popularity of this geek culture of people being like, ah, that was my first Genesis. I see it every day on my wall, brings it into a new context. It's absolutely timely. I'm actually a little surprised no one has thought of this before because it's like, duh, why doesn't this exist? I think it's going to runaway hit. I hope so.
I spent some time looking. I was like, surely someone's done this.
Right?
And, you know, I couldn't find any. Maybe someone's done, like, a piece here and there, but, you know, this idea of making, like, this, I haven't even seen that, frankly, but, you know, the idea of having this kind of series, you know, view of it and actually taking it seriously and not just doing it because geek is cool, you know, like, that certainly I haven't seen.
The only thing that I've seen that I could even think would be similar would be, I saw someone do, like, a small photography set of like game consoles and controllers, but in like not in their element, like and they're kind of replacing other known objects. So a great example is Super Nintendo controllers slung over power lines in a city, like instead of shoes and shoelaces.
Yeah, cool.
But other than that, I mean, that's like the only thing that I could even think of.
Yeah, that one's got a painted. Much more conceptual vibe and maybe making urban commentary.
Yeah, it's more kind of like juxtaposition between two different cultures type of a thing.
Yeah, you know, it's one of these ideas. I think it's been sitting under everyone's noses, including my own. And, you know. And so when I referenced, you know, Dave Palumbo's article, the thing about that is this whole Hearts for Hardware series really wouldn't exist if I hadn't done a 4x6 foot figurative painting.
Totally unrelated, but it
well, first stuck. Of all, like the squash was the intermediate step. So there were all these steps that were necessary to get me here. And I find that just as a painter, as a creative, I find that hugely interesting thinking back, you know, at where I am now, where my work's going and what I'm doing and how I had no idea that this was going to happen. You know, when I set about doing that big fantasy painting. So, very strange.
Well, I'm super excited for it. And, of course, we go over our half an hour allotted limit that we set on our, like, episode one. People always make fun of us.
We never do. We never do it.
We never do
it. We've never done. And I don't know. I don't know if it's like, I mean, I'm sure it's a good thing. Right? It'd be way better than if we had a guest.
Interesting.
Yeah. If we have a guest on and they talk for 5 minutes and we're like, oh, we have. What are we gonna like? What do we do? You know, I think that'd be way worse than,
right?
You know, I learned we can talk. It's fine with me.
I saw this show through the periphery, and I'm like, okay, we need to get Randy on this. I want to hear about it because it's unique, it's cool, it kind of straddles and brings this. Well, we talk about magic, sure, but then it's okay. Well, what happens when people leave magic? Like Donato stuff, he does his fine art, what have you. And this is almost a very approachable step to bring people interested in art, still with similar feels, into a little more fine art. And I assume a lot of these paintings aren't going to be a bajillion dollars, but they're going to be real art costed.
Yeah, you know what will happen, like you know what's going to happen, is someone's going to see this, and they're going to do, you know what, I'm going to do like a 10-foot Nintendo controller, and it'll sell in like Saatchi Gallery or something for $1 billion, and I'm going to cry. You know what's going to happen.
Or someone's going to commission you for that, and then be like, Randy, would you make me like 7 of these? And then you're going to be stuck in the Donato world saying, okay, fine, I'm painting
doing
a wall.
10-foot tall.
someone will have you do like a Sistine Chapel ceiling in their game room of just every single system and controller, and you'll just be on your back on scaffolding for months.
You know how unhappy.
Like, why did I paint that squash?
Exactly.
Why
Michelangelo
did I do
was
that?
So unhappy when he was on his back painting that thing. So.
Shake. Well, Randy, thank you so much for joining us. I had a lot of fun. I love
Super
hearing
fun.
About.
Yeah.
I love hearing about some of your works that don't get brought up every now and then. And you know, I think the show is going to be really fantastic. Anyone in Seattle should absolutely make a visit to it. And if you happen to be in Seattle that month, absolutely check it out. Even
yeah, I'll be up there for the show. So I'll be there for the opening and talking to people. So yeah, we'll talk video games all night long.
Well, very, very cool. So in the interim, how can people find out about you, the show? Is there a site that they can find to learn more about this?
So the details on the show, certainly crabjabstudio.com is central for that. With regards to my work in general, randyg.com is kind of the general hub. I set up a separate website for the video game stuff because I'm not going to have it take over my regular website because I still, you know, still do illustration and other kinds of work. And that is heartsforhardware.com. It's a Tumblr site. And so I don't, you know, everything related to that series will get posted there. But, you know, I spread everything. Everyone spreads everything around these days. Some of it's on Instagram, some's on Facebook or whatever, but that'll be the central location for that stuff.
Well, thank you so much again. You can find Randy that you're actually one of the few artists on Twitter that responds in a relatively timely fashion, which is great compared to others. You can find Ant on the Twitters. You can find me on the Twitters, or we write Gathering Magic articles every Wednesday talking about magic art and flavor. I want to thank everyone for watching. Go to the show. It looks friggin' sweet. Get in line early because that Genesis controller might be bought by me. Real talk.
Yeah. Exactly. I'd be nabbing the Super Nintendo. That'd be my game, man.
Yeah, that's we'll see
Super
about
Nintendo.
That.
I still have
the Genesis.
My,
they
my
can
original.
Be at the show, though. You know, the three button controller is not going to be at the show. That's going on Everyday Original.
I know. The Everyday Original. It's going to be long gone, but will be
others. The other ones will be there though at the show.
You can grab the six button, Mike.
The six button will be there. All right, guys. Nice talking to you.
Yep. Thanks so much, Randy. Take care.
Take care.